Anyone has been involved in an interview for a job in the corporate world today, you were probably asked a question that might go something, this would be just one of a hundred or several hundred examples. Tell us about a time when you worked with a team and had to deal with a situation that threatened the project that you were working on. What did you do and what was the result of that? So this is the kind of question that comes under, it has many different kind of copyrighted names, but it comes under kind of the general category of what they call behavioral descriptive interviewing. And so the whole idea is that rather than just simply asking people, tell us what you would do in a certain situation, you know, which makes it kind of theoretical, you have to give examples of what you actually did do that relate perhaps to the job that you are applying for. And so the idea is that past behavior predicts future performance. So this technique came out as a new invention a few years ago, probably a number of years ago, but it certainly looks like Paul already wrote the book on it. Not only does he list a number of the personality characteristics that a bishop or a deacon or layperson, in this case a woman that he refers to, should be known for, but they should already have a kind of a resume of experience at doing what they will be called to do in their leadership roles. In particular, he says, whoever aspires to the office of a bishop desires a noble task. He must be above reproach, temperate, sensible, an apt teacher, not a drunkard, not violent, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well, which means he must already have demonstrated the capacities and the capabilities of what it means to be a leader of the church community. I mean, we could go into kind of any one of these virtues or these concerns, these behavioral issues that are expressed for bishops or for deacons. But there's a particular concern for the bishop that is not likely to come up in a corporate interview, and that is something to do with the devil. I've never been asked about the devil in any interviews that I've been involved in. But Paul warns Timothy, his appointed bishop at Ephesus, that he should make sure not to fall into the snare of the devil. Avoidance of evil for bishops. Twice it's mentioned. So there is a sense that the spiritual leadership of a bishop makes it most important for them to behave well, and that we must pray for our bishops that they will not be tempted by evil. And we probably should know that that especially for our church leaders, our bishops, the devil has the greatest issue or concern that there not be good spiritual leadership, that Christ's authority not be manifested in the church. So I'm sure his attacks are directed at our Pope and our bishops. All share in the teaching authority of the bishop. So whether you're a deacon or whether you're a layperson who teaches, all of us share, we don't have our own teaching authority. We share in the authority of the bishop who receives that authority from Christ himself. One of the most things that I was most keenly aware of when I was ordained to the diaconate was that the church itself could be judged in the public by my behavior and my priorities. So Paul warns deacons to prove blameless and to hold to the mystery of our faith with a clear conscience. Women, which I think here represent all lay people, are also to hold to the virtues worthy of Christians, especially faithfulness in all things. Today's psalm beautifully highlights the most important qualities. I will walk with blameless heart. Isn't that a beautiful summary of all those futures, all those virtues? I will not set before my eyes anything that is base. So that's the other side, the temptation side. Let us not have anything in our lives that will lead us to temptation so that those virtues in our lives might be corrupted. In one of the extra readings from today's Office of Reading, St. Augustine describes the true pastor, whether bishop, priest, or deacon, who will not be among those who feed themselves and not the sheep. He will not be as happy at having his own needs met as he is when he sees the generosity of others towards each other. The gospel, the good news, is not to be sold, he says, by its preachers to make a living from it. That's not its purpose. That would be to sell something of great value for next to nothing. So when it comes to Jesus, we don't see someone auditioning or interviewing for the position of prophet or savior. What we see is God's own power, from where all truth and goodness and beauty come. He isn't going around looking for opportunities to strut his stuff, to show what he can do, to win a job or position. But he does it. He brings to bear God's own authority and power. We are to judge who has the qualities that we can trust to be the model of life for us. Look to Jesus. If we are interviewing for the position of savior of our souls, look to Jesus. Everywhere he goes, he demonstrates that he does what no one else does, what no one else can do, what no one else could even imagine being possible. He cuts through all of our ideas of what makes a person of integrity. In fact, he does meet our needs at the deepest levels where perhaps we are not even aware of what our needs are. What does Jesus do? Most obviously, he brings back to life what was dead. Have you ever thought that something in you, perhaps some spark of life or some dream, had died in you at some point in your life? See the many ways, even just in this short passage, that Jesus transforms death into life. He has a large crowd with him. People want to follow him. They meet another crowd of people who are with the widow whose son has died. One crowd follows the author of life. One crowd follows a dead man on a stretcher. And what does Jesus do? He joins the two crowds into one crowd of people who return to the town celebrating life itself. How does he perform this miracle of life? First, he touches the pallet. This is a shocking gesture because it makes him ritually unclean to have contact with a dead person. But by bringing the dead to life, he overturns the very cause of defilement and impurity. He makes what is unclean into what is clean. What is the result of his miracle? He gives the son back to his mother. In this way, Jesus reminds them and us that he is the great reconciler. Everything he does returns relationship to wholeness. Not even death can prevent this reconciliation. He transforms what has been dead into what is life-giving. Simply a word, rise. God has indeed looked favorably on his people. So St. Robert Bellarmine is today's saintly model. He describes love as heavenly action, in a sense. In this, he says, love never gets tired of doing what is right. Love never gets tired of any of the virtues that are mentioned in Paul's letter to Timothy today. Love never gets tired of behaving in a proper manner. He was greatly loved as a pastor. It tells us that he was a leader of the Catholic Reformation of the 16th century. Now, this was a true Reformation, not a rebellion or a tearing apart of the church. We can think of this when we see division in the church, in the world, or in our families. The model of St. Robert Bellarmine, what St. Paul was telling Timothy about the church in Ephesus, and what Jesus lives out in raising to life what was dead, we see the essence, the wholeness of the virtues, the reconciling love of God, which brings to life what may have been dead in us. And what are we called to do? To hold fast to what is true, to live in this life, to live in these virtues, to be with Jesus, the ones who bring to life what was dead.